Welcome to A Great Day for Hockey Talk with your host, Paul Steigerwald.
Paul Steigerwald standing by with his special guest. And let's go down the ladder right now and join him.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to It's a Great Day for Hockey Talk. I'm Paul Steigerwald, and it is my pleasure to have spent 45 minutes or so discussing the career of Eddie Olczyk with Edzo himself. And I think you're really going to enjoy this long conversation. It starts with his career here in Pittsburgh, but also his broadcasting career, his time as a coach here in Pittsburgh, and the challenges he faced with colon cancer. I mean, I can't stress enough what a great guy Edzo is. What you see is what you get. Everyone that he comes in contact with just thinks he's the greatest guy. He's such a nice person. He makes you feel good when you're in his presence, like you matter to him. And it goes all the way back to my first encounter with him as a broadcaster when I interviewed him between periods at a game in Winnipeg many, many years ago. I knew right away this was a special human, as he likes to say. So I think you're really going to enjoy this. I'm not going to give you his whole background of his career other than to say he played 16 seasons in the National Hockey League. He could score goals. He was drafted third overall behind Mario Lemieux and Kirk Muller in 1984, an American-born player from Chicago, Illinois, who had the career he had and who has had the profile he has had in the National Hockey League. That's something special in and of itself. So enjoy my conversation with the great Edzo. Let's start with your relationship with the Penguins. It began with you as a player. Could you talk about when you came to the Penguins as a player and what that was like? How did that happen, too, by the way?
Yeah, well, it was at the trade deadline of 96. 96-97 season. And I had signed a free agent contract with the LA Kings. And we were having a tough time out west, and I really did not hear my name at all in any trade rumors or any speculation at all, to be moved out of LA. And, next thing you know, my buddy Dominic, who's a lifelong friend and a legend amongst the hockey community, always traveling with me around, and Dom was in L.A. and we pushed back practice that day because of the time change and the 3-hour deadline and the 3 o'clock Eastern deadline. So we didn't have practice, I think, until 2 o'clock Pacific. And we were getting ready to leave for practice, and it's like 10 after 12. And Dom says, "Hey, you didn't get traded." And then the phone rings at the house. And of course, in 96, 97, Baggy, I didn't have a cell phone. I mean, I don't know who did, but I didn't. And the phone, it rings at the house, and it's Sam McMaster, our general manager, and he told me that we just traded to the Pittsburgh Penguins, and Craig Patrick will be getting a hold of you. And, and I have known Craig forever, it seems, from my days with USA Hockey, and, of course, Craig with the 80 Olympic team and myself on the 84 team. So that's how he became a Pittsburgh Penguin. And Glenn Murray went from the Penguins to L.A., and I came to Pittsburgh, and the rest is history.
And it's a pretty interesting history, because I think if that trade doesn't happen, your life's completely different. I mean, you end up in Pittsburgh, where a lot of good things happen for you that kind of led you down a different path. But you did get here late that season in 97. That happened to be the year Mario retired the first time. So do you remember what that was like? I think you played 12 games at the end of that season.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty, it was pretty inspiring, obviously, to come to a team. And obviously, getting drafted with Mario the same year, and knowing, what he had been through both on and off the ice, and coming there and, developing a relationship with him and with the great Ronnie Francis. Yags was here. So, I mean, there were some Tommy Barrasso, who I knew. So, I mean, there were, so many guys that I had either, crossed paths with or played with or admired as a hockey player. So to come here, you're right, Staggy, it opened up, another avenue down the road that I didn't know that was going to be there. But to get the opportunity to come here and, like I said, knowing Craig, I think that, it just it worked out. Maybe it didn't work out in the hockey aspect of it, because I certainly enjoyed playing here and putting on the Penguin uniform, but it certainly opened up the doors to some other great chapters in my life.
Well, things changed dramatically to your first year, a full season with the Penguins, because Kevin Constantine came in, and
right.
he was the coach, and the whole style of the team changed. Was that a tough adjustment for you to have to deal with Mario being gone? And I know Ronnie was here, and you said Yags and Tom Barrasso and Marty Straka, and there were a lot of good hockey players that played that year under Kevin, but what was it like for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I was in, it was a kind of a transition time in my career, Staggy. I mean, I go back to when I left Winnipeg for the first time back in the 92-93 season, where, you know, I had come off of five straight years of scoring 30-plus goals in the NHL. So from 87 to 92-93, the 92 season, I guess I should say, from 87 and the 92 season, I'd scored 30-plus goals for five straight seasons. And there was only seven players in the NHL that had done that for 5 years. And some of the names on that list, of course, were Lemieux and Hull and Gretzky and Robitaille and Yzerman and Gartner. And somehow I ended up on that list. And, you know, I had the ability to put the puck in the back of the net. But once I got to New York, it kind of seemed like individually or personally, you know, my career came to a screeching halt, and I could really just kind of never get back on track. I did when I got traded back to Winnipeg after my quick stint in New York and winning a Stanley Cup in 94. But, you know, when I got to Pittsburgh, I mean, Craig gave me a great opportunity. I played a lot, had an impact, you know, as a role player, and, you know, whether I had a shift with Mario, or have a shift with Ronnie Francis, or have a shift with Ian Moran and Tyler Wright. I mean, you know, it didn't matter. I mean, I knew what my role was. And then when Kevin Constantine came in, I mean, he had his mind made up on whatever role that I was going to have. So it was a very, very difficult season. I got put on waivers, I think, that year at one point. I had a young family. So it certainly was a difficult season, made it through. Then eventually worked my way back home to Chicago, where they signed me to a couple of one-year deals, and then eventually retired in 2000. So, but, you know, look, I played for many a coaches over my career, and there were some guys that appreciated what I couldn't do and what I could do, and understood what my strengths and what my weaknesses were. And some coaches just had the ability. And look, it happens in all walks of life. It's just not hockey, is that somebody's going to paint you with a brush, and you know, your fate is pretty much sealed even before you do anything. So disappointed that they didn't get an opportunity, but you know, that's the real world. So we learned from it and moved on. And but that, you know, that first full season in the Berg was you know, was pretty difficult. But the last couple of years, I think, kind of helped prepare me for what was ahead.
It's amazing to me, and it always has been amazing to me in hockey, how you could score goals, and that's a very hard thing to do. And yet,
yeah,
coaches tend to sometimes focus on the things you can't do and not realize
right,
that the one thing you can is put the puck in the net, which a lot of people would pray, and they would maybe sell their soul to the devil to be able to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think I learned that when, you know, and I'm going ahead a little bit here, Staggy, but I think I learned that when I became a coach of the Penguins and sitting in on those meetings with Craig and with our you know, coaching staff and our management staff. And I think it's the one thing that I'd like to think it's starting to weed itself out because of the rule changes, and I think that certainly has something to do with it. But the old school of thought is, you know, teams looking at players that they have, or maybe players they're looking to acquire, and, you know, their mindset would be, well, this guy ain't tough enough. You know, he doesn't score. He doesn't hit. Well, hold on a second. Well, what the hell can he do? Like, and then it's up to us as an organization or a coaching staff to put this player in a situation where he can have success. And whether it's a goal scorer, whether it's a tough guy, whether it's a defender, regardless of what it is. But I do think that the train of thought has changed. But it's something that I took to heart because I lived it as a player. It's like, okay, yeah, we have Rico Fonda, or we have Konstantin Koltsov, or we have Dick Tarnstrom. Yeah, okay. There are very few players, Daggy, and you know this as well as anybody, especially here in the Berg or throughout the National Hockey League. There have been very few perfect players ever to play in the National Hockey League. There's been some close ones.
Yep.
No doubt. And one of them wore 66 here in the Berg. I know that. But most players that have ever come through the National Hockey League or the Pittsburgh Penguins, they've all had holes. They've all had blemishes. So it's up to the team and the coach to put those guys in a situation where they can help. Figure out who and what the hell your players are before the rest of the hockey league does, and you'll be in a good place. So, you know, you're right. I think it was an older school mentality. I think it's changed a bit because of the rule changes. Now you have, you know, really small guys playing in a National Hockey League where 25 years ago there was no chance that, you know, teams would even give smaller players in the National Hockey League today an opportunity because they just didn't think that they could survive. But look, you got some of the best players in the league are a little bit, you know, are slight.
Johnny Gaudreau. Think of Johnny Gaudreau.
Right. Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, so, you know, the game has changed and, you know, the way we think has changed, I hope, but that there is no doubt what you're talking about certainly resonates with me and going through my 16 years in what I think the greatest league in the world.
So, Edzo, you go back to Chicago, and I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on that, but it is, to me, a really interesting aspect of your whole career is that you came from Chicago. And, you know, just, I mean, today we have a lot of kids from the U.S. coming from, you know, from Scottsdale, Arizona. But, I mean, back then that was not the case. So you were sort of a pioneer, I would say.
Well, I'd like to think so, Staggy. You know, yeah, there weren't a lot of young Chicago kids born and bred that thought about going to the National Hockey League, let alone playing hockey in the suburbs of Chicago. So, I mean, I had the opportunity, and once I got put on a pair of skates when I was 6.5 years old, I was hooked. You know, it was hook, line, and sinker, and I enjoyed, you know, growing up as a kid and playing games. And I played baseball in the off season. That's one thing that my dad emphasized to me as a young kid is that, you know, play all sports. You know, like my dad wanted me to play football, but I wasn't tough enough to play football. But I love baseball, and I would play baseball for 3-4 months at a time in the summer and the spring, and would get away from hockey for a period of time until hockey became, you know, 13 months a year when I turned 13 or 14. But not a lot of kids came from the state of Illinois, let alone the suburbs of Chicago, and I was very, very lucky to be, you know, one of those first guys. Chris Chelios, no question. The greatest American-born hockey player ever to play in a National Hockey League, in my opinion, and a guy that was a Chicago guy himself and obviously has had an amazing career. But it gave me everything I have. I owe to the game of hockey, and I started as a young kid growing up in Chicago.
Well, you're a man of great personality, and there's no question that that's a big reason why you are where you are today. And I can remember interviewing you in Winnipeg between periods, and you came in with that. you were just so affable and so easy to talk to, and a great interview. And I used to tell Mike Lang every now and then, hey, boy, that guy, he has a future in broadcasting if he wants, because he's really good. And you just had that written all over you.
Let's talk about Eddie Olczyk. He doesn't get a lot of credit as much as some people, you know, should give him, and yourself. What do you think about Eddie?
He's got one.
And
of the,
don't be brief either.
He's got one of the loudest voices in the National Hockey League.
No, let's talk about his play, though. I mean, we know he's a good guy, and he's a great family guy, and he likes to bet on the horses. Doesn't make him a bad guy, though.
Well, his play, he plays great music on the bus.
He likes disco.
Loves disco. Disco Inferno is one of
the shake his booty?
Shakes his booty as well as anybody in hockey. He's got a big booty, too.
That's not funny.
That? I'm having a little fun. You're making fun of my rump. Edmar Foods, what do you mean? I got a lot of pierogies there.
So I don't know if you know this, Edzo, but we were looking for a new color analyst in Pittsburgh, and I remember being in a meeting. I think it was myself. Mike Lang was there. It was Paul Kasuth, who was a producer at the time. I believe Jane Adair, who was in charge of FSN at the time. And I think I chimed in. Mike and I both kind of chimed in to say, you got to see if you can get Eddie Olczyk. He would be unbelievable. Yeah. Is that how I was trying to remember how you ended up, like, had you already had some broadcast experience when you came to Pittsburgh?
Yeah.
Or was that, yeah. How did we know that you were so good already? I mean, I think I would have.
Well, I appreciate that, Staggy. And, yeah, that's exactly what happened. I know that you guys had throw my name out there, and you know, the so-called rest is history, as I said earlier. But you know, I had been doing some TV work for ESPN when I was knocked out of the playoffs, whether I was in Winnipeg or with the Blackhawks. So ESPN had hired me to do some games. I also was doing NHL radio on Westwood One. I would do some playoff games there and was ended up doing like the conference finals. And so, I mean, I had had broadcasting experience when it came to the hockey part of it. But a lot of people don't know this, Staggy, is that I actually got my start in television in the lockout of 1994. So I'm in New York with the Rangers. We just won the Stanley Cup. And the next year we had a work stoppage. And I actually think I had a hat trick, a preseason hat trick against the Penguins here in the Berg. And, you know, I was feeling good. I hadn't played a lot the year before. We won the Cup. There were a lot of changes and was really looking forward to the season. I had a great training camp. And, you know, then we went on, you know, then we had the work stoppage. So, as everybody knows, and if you don't know, I guess I'm leading you into this story, is that, you know, I'm a big horse racing guy. Always have been, always will be. And the people at the Meadowlands Racetrack were big Ranger fans. And winning a Stanley Cup, I brought the Stanley Cup to the Meadowlands in East Rutherford, New Jersey, and had a little bit of a party there. And we had the work stoppage. So the people at the Meadowlands Racetrack, Staggy, called me and said, hey, you're not working. You know, why don't you come handicap the races for us until you go back to work? And I'm like, you're going to pay me to come to the racetrack? I'm like, this is like the greatest thing in the world. Like, you're going to pay me $800 a day. And they probably knew it was just going to go right back to the windows anyways. But, you know, so that's how I got my start in television. So I worked with a lady by the name of Barbara Foster. She was my partner at the Meadowlands. We were doing the thoroughbred meet, and I would handicap each race, and then we would do the wrap-up report on Sports Channel America after. And, you know, so that's how I got my introduction to television. And, you know, push the clock some 20 years later, I get the job with NBC, and then I'm doing horse racing in the Triple Crown. So I think that, you know, yeah, the Penguins knew that, you know, the relationship obviously playing here and then doing the games on television for ESPN and radio on NHL radio, but also I actually got my start in broadcasting and television at the racetrack.
And it was so cool because when you became the color analyst of the Penguins, at that time the Penguins were in need of a little extra juice on the telecast. The team wasn't great, as I recall. I'm trying to remember what year it was, but in any event, there were some good times and some bad times. But what I remember most is that you became a pretty popular color analyst by virtue of having a really good relationship with the fans at the arena. Remember, you used to, did we call it the Ed, was it called the Ed Zone? What did we call that?
Yeah, circle me Ed Zone.
Well, if you haven't had lunch yet, how about a Subway sandwich of the game? Danny Lacouture on Patrick Stefan. Shift playing left wing the next. You start running around. This young lady likes how I circle, so you know what? There you go. That's a nice sign.
Better, sir.
Yeah, Circle Me Edzo was a great thing, and you used to circle with the telestrator. But you sat in the, I remember a couple of times you even sat in the balcony at the Civic Arena during the game to do the game, right? With the fans.
Yeah, it was an amazing experience. It looked to be, you know, to be around you guys, and obviously you and Mikey being together for such a long time, and then, you know, you moving to the radio, and then me getting the opportunity to sit next to a legend, and became just great friends with the great Mike Lang, and helped me so much in my broadcasting career. And yeah, I mean, you know, we had a lot of fun. I mean, we did. And, you know, let's not forget that, you know, that my first year, of course, Mario came back in that amazing game against the Toronto Maple Leafs after Christmas time. And, you know, so, I mean, for me, it was just like it was an incredible run to be back in the Berg. And, you know, the team was, you know, the team was on the verge of going to another Stanley Cup final. Mario comes back. And, you know, I remember Casper, I think it was. Wasn't it Casper that scored that overtime winner?
Yeah. Yes, it was.
Seven. So, you know, I mean, we had, it was, like you really felt like, you know, you were you became a part of the fabric of the community. And, you know, I thought we did just a great job on the broadcast and not only selling the game and the brand, but, you know, I mean, Mikey and I had a, you know, we had a stick, and you're right, yeah, sometimes they'd be out in the crowd, and you know, I think we were passing out Twizzlers or Swedish Fish or, you know, you're right, circling the fans and just making them, you know, getting them engaged. And it really helped catapult me to my broadcasting career, the full-time opportunity. I'll be forever grateful to Mario and to Craig and to Tommy Mack and to, you know, everybody at Fox Sports Pittsburgh and that gave me the chance. And look, I commuted from Chicago to Pittsburgh for 3 years. I wasn't going to move my family again because we had bounced around a lot and the kids, I wanted some stability at home. So it certainly wasn't easy on my wife, Diana. We just celebrated our 30th wedding anniversary this past August. So it wasn't easy, but the team made it very easy. And it was a great, great time in my life. And maybe when my book comes out, so people will get a chance to read a little bit more into the relationship with Mikey and how that all kind of really kind of took place here in the Birds.
Really, really good stuff. And, you know, I don't know how many people have gone from the broadcast booth to behind a bench, but I think it happened maybe in baseball, but I don't
basketball
know.
Basketball now, basketball. Yeah, yeah. It's happened a lot more now, Staggy.
But you were the first one to do it, right?
Yeah, one of the pioneers. And look, just to take people back, like back in 03, the Penguins did not have any coaches in the organization. Craig made, you know, complete changes, you know, up and down the organization. And it's something I had thought about. It's something that I had talked about with Craig and Mario, you know, over the course of the time when I was in the Berg. And I knew the situation in club at the National Hockey League levels that, look, you know, didn't know what was going to happen with the team. We were falling on tough times. You know, we were cutting payroll. But I wanted to get into the teaching part and the coaching part. And when I went in for my first interview with Craig, my mind was set on going to Wilkes-Barre, and I applied for the head coaching job for the American Hockey League and going to Wilkes-Barre Scranton. Like, that's how it all started. And one thing led to another, and, you know, and then it became talk about the parent club. And, you know, and Craig had never had a head coaching job in his life until he coached the New York Rangers. Yes, Craig was involved in the game, and yes, he was an assistant coach with the Olympic team, obviously, in 1980. But Craig Patrick's first head coaching job wasn't until he got to the National Hockey League. And I think that certainly, you know, played in my favor. Now I look back and go, you know, what would have been best for me, and how would things have worked out? I think about it for sure, especially when the Penguins were winning all those Stanley Cups, you know, 4 or 5 years shortly after I was coaching. But, you know, I mean, hey, that's the hand that was dealt. But that's how it all started, is I was prepared to go to the American Hockey League and coach in Wilkes-Barre and let things happen from there. But, you know, things happen and decisions are made, and I wouldn't change. I would not change anything. I really wouldn't, Staggy. The opportunity that I had, I think, made me a better hockey guy. I think it made me a better broadcaster. It helped teach me about the game, and you know, I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about the business of the game, and it's a proud time of my life to have gone from, you know, the broadcast booth to behind the bench and being around and seeing, you know, Marc-Andre Fleury and getting a chance to be around Mario and being there when the Penguins drafted Evgeny Malkin, and then being there when we won the lottery against Anaheim and winning the draft lottery and getting a chance to take Sid. So, I mean, there's so many positives. And, yeah, it didn't end anywhere the way that I would have liked. And I felt like I'd let Mario down, I'd let Craig down, and yeah, I'd let the fan base down. But that's the nature of the business, and I understand that. And, like I said, I've always tried to take the positive in a tough situation. So, but, again, I go back to, you know, when I wanted to get into coaching, because I always enjoyed it. I always kind of felt like I was a, you know, I had a reputation of taking young guys under my wing and kind of help showing them the way. And I don't want to say being a second coach, because that's I wouldn't want to use that terminology, but I just always tried to, you know, to try to lead and help. Nothing easy about playing in a league, but just, you know, try to help guys along. And I think it came to a point where I felt like I had so much more to offer. And like I said, my plan was to go to Wilkes-Barre or at least apply for the Wilkes-Barre job. And next thing you know, I got the opportunity to coach Pittsburgh Penguins.
And I saw in your interview you did for the 50th anniversary documentary that the Penguins did, you said we were selling hope. And I have a tremendous recall of how well the team played for you that at the end of that season, Alexei Morozov went on a tear, and there was a tremendous amount of pride among those players. They knew that some crazy things were coming. You know, they knew the lockout was coming. They knew that there was going to be severe changes with respect to the Penguins organization, and yet they took some kind of pride in wanting to put their best foot forward, and then you made a speech on the ice.
Thank you. Thank you very much. On behalf of the Pittsburgh Penguins, it's great to have the building full, isn't it? Give yourselves a round of applause. On behalf of the players, the coaches, our ownership led by Mario Lemieux, Craig Patrick, and all the people behind the scenes that, unfortunately for you great people, you don't get a chance to meet. All the people in our ticket office, all the people in our media relations, our training staff, the people that really make this organization go. We'd like to thank you for your support this year. The one thing I am most proud of, the one thing I am most proud of is from day one with Craig and with Mario is we've had a plan. And we've stuck to our plan from day one. All of our young players got an opportunity to play in game one and in game 82. I would also like to thank the entire Penguin organization for making myself and my family feel a great part of this great city again. And the players that are going to come out here and give you the shirts off their backs are not only representing Mario Lemieux and the Pittsburgh Penguins, but they're representing every single one of us that lives in the city of Pittsburgh. And we thank you very much for your support.
And so that was sort of in keeping with the fact that you'd been a broadcaster. You had this relationship with the fans. Very few guys could do that or would want to do it. You know, we had coaches here that would hide and not even want to be seen on the ice, you know. This was a completely different approach. So for you to say you let somebody down is ridiculous, because you actually did exactly what it was they wanted you to do. You created this feeling of optimism at the end of that season going into a horrible time in NHL history, really.
Yeah, well, no, I appreciate that, Staggy. And I think, you know, I was there to sell hope. I was there to be the spokesperson. There's no doubt about that. I mean, something that, you know, Craig at times he had to do, but I don't think that Craig wanted to do it. Look, and that was a strength of mine, is to be able to reach out and communicate with the great fan base here in the Berg and Penguin fans all across the world. And I knew that. You're right. I mean, it was about selling hope. Like, we divulged a lot. Like, we didn't divulge everything, but we wanted our fan base to understand where we were, where we are, and where we're trying to get to. And that was a part of my job, and that was a huge part of my job description. And, you know, look, it wasn't easy. You know, that year, we went 17 games without winning a game. Now, look, granted, we didn't have a lot of talent on that team. We pretty much went bare bones, and, you know, like, it was tough. It was tough to keep the guys up. And, you know, you're right. Everybody knew there were changes. You know, we didn't know what was going to take place, you know, with the franchise or anything like that. But we knew that there were changes coming, and there was a pretty good chance there was going to be a work stoppage. But all I tried to continue to do was to build my guys up, believe in them, and give them an opportunity to either sell themselves locally or sell themselves to somebody else in the National Hockey League. And be forever grateful for that last 20 games. I'll never forget it, ending that streak in Arizona. I'll never forget it, Staggy. We're in Arizona, and I woke up in the morning, and I turned on the TV, and I think the show on ESPN2 was on. I think it was Cold Pizza or a show like that. And who comes on my TV screen but Double M, Mark Madden on my TV. And again, I'm coaching. We had lost 17. We had not won in 17 games. I think we were like 0-10-7 or something like that. But so I see Mark on there, and now they're starting to put in. Mark's talking about the team and, you know, not winning in 17, and starting to put up a graphic of teams that had gone, you know, 23 and 25 games without winning. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, like, I'm just like, you know, like, when's this going to end, you know? And it's a beautiful day in Arizona, and I went for a little bit of a walk and got to the rink, and we played our plums off. Like, we absolutely just played a really good game. And I remember we got to overtime, called a timeout. I think we had a power play and drew up a play, and can't remember who won the faceoff. Might have been Rico. Got the puck back to Dickie Tarnstrom and Rick Jackman, and somehow the puck ended up in the back of the net, and we stopped the streak. And it was like, I mean, it was, I couldn't have been more happy for the guys. I mean, it just, you know, like, you keep building them up, you keep telling them it's going to get better, and you keep tying or losing, and like, it's demoralizing. There's no doubt about it. But since that point, you know, we went the last 20 games. I think we went 12-5-3 the last 20 games of the regular season, and actually had the second best record of anybody in the National Hockey League those last 20 games. So we stayed with it, didn't do anything more or anything less as the coaching staff, Randy Hillier and Joey Mullen and Lauren Mollican. But, you know, the guys just stuck with it, and we found a way to have a really good end to that season before the work stoppage the next year.
I think Andy Kyoto got the win. He was in goal.
Yeah.
Bobby Airy called him the Kyoto Dragon.
That's it. That's
He's still working.
It might have been Itchy Scratchy Tabarachi. I was really going back in the day there.
Hey, Enzo. Andy Kyoto still works for the Penguins now. Did you know that? He's working as a...
I did not know that.
Yeah, he's working as a development coach, a goalie for goaltending.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. That is awesome.
Listen, you worked with Mike Lang. You also have worked now with Pat Foley, the voice of the Chicago Blackhawks, and you've worked with Doc Emrick, and among others. But those are three pretty legendary figures. You could maybe, if you had a Mount Rushmore, I would say that of hockey, they would certainly be up there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm one lucky human. There's no doubt about it. To sit in those chairs, you know, to sit next to Mikey, my first partner, who helped me a lot. We had so much fun together. He helped me a lot. He helped me become, no question, a better person, a better man, and a better broadcaster. But to sit next to him, a legend in the burg, as you know, Staggy, not an easy job. A very intimidating chair to sit in. And I've worked now with Pat Foley for 10 years, and somebody that I grew up listening to as a young hockey fan in Chicago, listening to him and the great Dale Talon, who now is the general manager of the Florida Panthers. I mean, Dale and Pat, that's a shtick and a half, and they're legendary in Chicago.
Yeah, they were.
So another intimidating chair to sit in. Every night in Chicago, and then to get a chance to work with Doc on the national broadcast, and just helped me so much, both on and off the booth, and I'm just very, very lucky. And you got to be on your toes with all three of those guys, as you know, Saggy. I mean, you got to be a good listener. You got to be prepared, because all three have the ability to jump off the highway for about 2 minutes. And you got to be able to pick up the pieces and get us back on and get the rig back on the road. And, but I have been blessed to work next to a lot of great broadcasters. But when I think about my partners, certainly the three gentlemen you made mention of, Mikey, Pat, and Doc, very, very lucky. And all are tremendous people, tremendous friends, and have had a huge impact on the Olchek family. And have helped me become the person and the broadcaster I am some you know, I guess some 20 years later, which is really hard to believe that I've been a part-time broadcaster and also a full-time broadcaster over the course of the last 14 years.
And I think it's really cool that you worked with those three, because I think of those three as being so different stylistically, but what connects them is that they all have a distinctive style and sound to their voices. Each one has his own really distinctive style. They don't sound like anybody else. Maybe people who try to sound like them. But it is interesting. They're all doing the same job, and yet they're completely different in the way they do it. It's so cool.
Yeah, and they all have the ability, and again, doing the thousands of games that I have with all three of them is the ability, Saggy, and you know this from wearing that hat as well yourself, is to be able to weave in and out of a story without losing the listener or the viewer, you know, to get in and to get out or to set up your partner. I mean, that's the one thing too. And as, you know, being one half of the booth is the ability to be able to communicate, talk to, not talk down to the people that are watching, to be able to not talk down to your diehard hockey fans who know exactly, you know, what the width of the blade of the stick is to somebody that might not know what a two-line pass was or what, you know, what a delayed offside is. So, you know, they all have that incredible ability to draw in your partner and to make them feel like they're a part of it. And I think, you know, the one thing that is very common with all three is the genuine respect and the genuine feel of the game. You know, to know when to lay out, to know when to bring me in, and to know when it's Mikey time, it's Pat time, and it's Doc time, and then that's my opportunity to just keep my mouth shut. And look, I get a lot of texts during games, and people sometimes will go, "Are you working tonight or what? Like, are you going to say anything?" I'm like, "Hey, look, when the captain of the ship is directing." You let them go, and there's that certain time, because you know this, it's going to happen. It's happened to me, I think, three times in my career, is where I'm sitting there and, you know, like you want to get in, you want to give your partner a quick little breather, and all of a sudden you start talking, and all of a sudden you open up your big mouth, and next thing you know, the puck ends up in the back of the net. Like, there's no worse feeling as a color guy to have that happen. It's going to happen because it's live, and, you know, you're going to make mistakes, but when it's their time, you know, you let it go, and then you jump in when you can. But just, I'm very lucky. It's honoring. It's intimidating. And I feel like the luckiest guy in the world is have sit next to those guys for all the years I've been a broadcaster. And real quick, Saggy, if I can, I'd like to tell a Mikey story if I can.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, Mikey, we always had this, you know, part of our part of the shtick on our shows where, you know, we always say that Mikey would get stuck in the elevator, you know, when Mikey was a little late getting back to the broadcast booth. So Mikey always had to go stretch his legs and stretch his lungs every once in a while. People know what the hell I'm talking about. But so it happened two different times with me anyways. And I'm sure with you it probably happened more than that. You're much more versed of calling a game than I ever have been. But we were in the island. And Mikey got stuck in the elevator, and puck drop is coming, and I'm looking over my shoulder, and I'm like, "Where in the hell is he? Like, I got to start calling the game. Like, I got to start calling the play-by-play."
That happened to me too, by the way.
I know. So sure enough, we're on the power play. The Penguins are on the power play, and I'm like, "Oh no, please don't score! Like, what kind of goal call am I going to have? You know?" So sure enough, the puck ends up, I don't know if it ended up on Marty's stick or Yuri Slager's stick, but he gets it over to the commander, gets it over to Kobe, and Kobe goes top shelf in the island. So I got to call a goal, right? And I don't know what I said. I think I must have watched Sam Rosen night before, because I said, "It's a power play goal," you know?
Yeah.
So thank God Mikey shows up, right? And he comes, yeah, he's late. You know, he's like a minute and a half late, like no big deal. I'm like, "Where are you been? The elevator again?" He goes, "Yep." You know, so we come back, and, you know, like 5 or 6 minutes into the period, Mikey, and I would read all the promos for the most part, you know, and I always enjoyed it, and I still do in Chicago, and sometimes I'll read some on NBC. But so this particular one, we had our call of the game, And I didn't get to read it. Mikey goes, I got this one in the great Edzo. And he goes, let's go to the call of the game. So they replay my call.
I got to find that. Brutal. We got to find that telecast. That's got to be somewhere.
No, you don't. And Mikey goes after. He goes, Edzo, you got a little Sam Rosen in you.
That's so funny.
And the other time was in Florida where Mikey got stuck in the stairwell. So he had to walk all the way down in Sunrise, work himself back to the elevator and get up. Thank God there was no goal call, no goal that happened. So you had to hear my horrendous call. But a lot of great stories with Mikey. But I think that one, the getting stuck in the elevator, because I always had, even today, Saggy, every once in a while while I'm traveling in the Berg, and I haven't been back, obviously, a lot because the last year of my, you know, my battle with stage 3 colon cancer, I didn't get it to the Berg last year, but I've only been in once this year. But, you know, over the time, I've every once in a while somebody will go, hey, can you please tell me something? Well, what did you mean when you'd always say that Mikey got stuck in the elevator? Like, whoa. And the best part is an inside joke. And, you know, Mikey always, like I said, wanted to stretch his legs and stretch his lungs, and we'll leave it at that.
You know, Edzo, I'll tell you this really quick story. We were in Washington, and Mike was having some stomach distress. You know, and sometimes you're broadcasting a game, and you got – nature calls, and there's not a whole lot you can do. I mean, you're stuck. That's a tough place to be. But anyway, Mikey's having some stomach problems, and he's telling me, you know, I might have to leave, you know. So so he starts going, she'll be coming around the mountain when she comes. He starts singing that on the air. Next thing you know, he's gone, and I'm calling the game in Washington for a while, and he came back. Same thing. But hey, listen, you know. That happens, and I've talked to him about that. He said that's the worst. He hates that when that happens, but it does. And when you're calling hockey games and you can't leave, there's a commercial break. You're there, man. Nobody, you know, there's not much you can do.
Yeah,
and you better have a color guy who's willing to jump in like you did.
Yeah, I told him. I said, you know what, Mike? You got to change your eating habits a little bit. You got to try to eat like a normal human. You got to be eating at 4 in the morning all the time, you know. So
that's
that was great.
Stuff.
I love Mikey. I anytime I see him, I got a chance to see him or the Penguins Lightning game, and it's always good to see him. My day is always better anytime I get a chance to see him. And you know, we exchange texts and phone calls every once in a while, and always check in with Mad Dog, the old 2-9er, my former roommate with the Rangers, by the way. I don't know if people knew that. I roomed with the old 2-9er in New York when we were together with the Rangers back in the early 90s. But I always check in with Mad Dog to make sure that Mikey's doing okay. So, yeah, some great times. And I'll never forget the roast we had for him, too, Staggy. Remember the roast?
Oh, the roast. That was a lot of fun. Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
Gosh, that's like 1,000 years. How old is this guy? He's older than Osama, this guy.
Hey, speaking of your health, how you doing?
Yeah, feeling good, Staggy. Yeah, it's been a year since I stopped my almost a year, I guess. February 21st of last year is when I stopped my last chemo treatment and got the clean bill of health in early March. And I'm feeling good. I got my big scan coming up in late February. But all my other tests that I've had are clean. I had a colonoscopy 6 weeks ago, and everything looked clean. The doctor told me it looks like a 21-year-old, so that's good. It's about the only thing I got going for me is that my colon looks like a 21-year-old. But but I don't have to have one for another 3 years, so I recommend to everybody out there. They've actually lowered the national average age for recommendation for a colonoscopy to 45, because when I was 6, Staggy, it was 50 nationally. And somehow, some way, over my battle, they lowered the age to 45 because the uptick in colon cancer has been very dramatic. So I would encourage anybody out there to make sure that they raise their hand and go get checked out, or somebody that they know, to make sure they take them in. Because, you know what? Literally, it's pretty shitty for a day with the colonoscopy, but I would trade that in for anything that have to go through 6 months of hell of chemotherapy. And anybody out there that's listening certainly knows what I'm talking about. You would trade in that one bad day for not having to go through 6 months of hell, because that's exactly what happened with me and my family. So I would encourage everybody out there to make sure they're getting looked after. But I'm feeling good, and the farther I get away from last year, Staggy, the better I feel. So I'm feeling good and back to a normal schedule. And again, I'd be remiss if I did not thank you and all the great fans in Pittsburgh, the Penguin organization, all those hockey and horse racing fans out there that reached out to me, whether it was via text or a phone call or email or just those prayers out there. It really helped a lot, and I really felt like, you know, we did it. We beat this disease, and I don't think I could ever done it by myself. And my wife, Diana, was certainly the rock, and my family and my friends and the people in Chicago and the Blackhawks and everybody else. But it was quite the battle, and now my goal is to try to help keep one person from having to go through what I went through, Staggy. But sadly, as we know, it's going to touch somebody, and hopefully somebody knows my story and knows the battles that I went through, and hopefully I can help them get through their battle, because I had a lot of people help me, and that's kind of my goal. And I think that's kind of like my purpose in life now, is to let people know my story, and that one day I woke up and I couldn't go to the bathroom. Like, I couldn't go number two. Like, I was clogged up, and that was not normal for me. And next thing you know, some 3 days later, I'm having a six-hour surgery removing 16 inches of my colon and a tumor the size of my fist that was blocking my colon. And, you know, and then I'm taking 6 months of chemo and not knowing what the hell was going to happen. And, look, I'm still scared, but I'd like to think that people hear my story and will go get checked out and stay away from it, or hopefully inspire somebody to battle through, because it does test your will to live. It tests your will to fight. You question your mortality. People ask me now, Staggy, having gone through that, do I look at things differently? And I quite honestly can say is that I really don't. I think when I was going through that, Staggy, I was wondering, you know, like, am I going to see my kids continue to grow up? Am I going to continue to be with my wife of 30 years? Am I going to be around for my son's wedding this past August? But I think why I was at such peace is that everybody in my so-called inner circle, or the people that mean the most to me, or the people that I come across, like, Staggy, you know me fairly well, is that I've always tried to make people feel good about themselves regardless of what the situation may be, whether you've won 10 or lost 10, or you've scored 3 or you're minus 5. Like, in hockey, I think the culture and everything, like, I've always tried to, you know, the great trainers we had in the Berg, or the trainers that I've had in my life, that's always been an important part of my life. And I've always tried to make people feel good about themselves and try to brighten up their day regardless of what it is with my personality. And I think what I'm getting at is that when I was sitting there wondering if I was going to make it, is the people in my so-called inner circle always have known what they have meant to me. And my wife would always, you know, not get mad at me, but she didn't want to, you know, she didn't want to talk about it. But I always told my wife that, look, I want you to know that you're the greatest thing and our kids are the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. And I want you to know that, God forbid, if something that would happen to me. And I think when I was going through that battle, Staggy, I was at peace. And if it wasn't in the cards for me to make it, at least I was at peace, knowing that the most important people in the game of hockey and in horse racing, the people and the things that have given me so much in my life, they knew how much they meant to me, and I was at peace. And I think there's a lesson there to be learned in a lot of aspects, whether you're battling cancer or you're battling in a job, or, you know, you're having family issues or mental health issues. I think that somebody could take from that, and that's why I want to try to be so proactive on people knowing my story. And again, I know there are people a lot worse off and will continue to be way worse off than Eddie Olczyk. I understand that, but if I could help one person stay away from it, deal with it by knowing my story, then it was well worth me spending time on it. And I appreciate you giving me the chance to do that, because maybe out there, Staggy, we're helping one person move along in their life, and hopefully they can be better off from knowing my story and help somebody along as well.
Well, I'll tell you, I think everybody who's ever had a chance to work with you or get to know you at all, and, you know, traveling with you, it was just so much fun, and you're always such a joy to be around, Edzo, and you're really one of the great people in sports I've ever come across, and I know anybody who's worked with you and gotten to know you here in the Berg would say the same thing. I look forward to the book. When are you going to put it out?
Well, I think we're getting pretty darn close here, Staggy. I think we're looking maybe for November of this year, and it will be a lot about, obviously, my battle, what I just went through, because I want it to be more than just a hockey book. I want it to be a book about, you know, my battles and my life. And look, it's funny, and I guess I could just tease it a little bit. Like, my whole life, Staggy, I always had people telling me that I would not accomplish certain things. When I was a kid growing up in Chicago, you know, I had people tell me, oh, you'll never make it to the NHL because you're American-born and you're from Chicago. I had people tell me that I wouldn't make the U.S. Olympic hockey team when I was 16 years old back in 1984 after the miracle on ice in Lake Placid in 1980. Everybody told me I wouldn't make it because I was too young. There were some people that told me that I would, listen to me closely, some people told me that I would eat my way out of the National Hockey League. Now, I asked you, Staggy, what's wrong with a hungry hockey player, right? Like, we love hungry hockey.
You're a hungry human.
That's it, a hungry human. We love hungry humans. And, you know, and people would tell me that I would never be the lead analyst on, you know, American television as an American-born broadcaster, because it's always been Canadian-bred and born broadcasters that would come down to the States and play here and be the lead broadcaster. So my whole life, I always had people telling me that I couldn't do things. And I didn't do those things or achieve those things to prove people wrong. I did them because I felt that I could and I wanted to. But the interesting thing, Staggy, to tie it all in, is that besides a couple of people on social media that wanted to see me 6 feet under, I did not have one person tell me that I was not going to beat this disease. And that, to me, is really kind of coming full circle. So we're going to touch on my battle. We're going to touch on where I came from. There's going to be a lot of hockey stories in there. There's going to be a few horse racing and gambling stories and some of the great characters that I've either roomed with or worked with. Of course, Mikey will be a big part of that, the great Mike Lang. My time coaching in the Berg and what it was like to be around Sidney Crosby. So we're getting close to the end. So it's very exciting. We're trying to figure out some pictures, and as one of my former teammates told me, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of crayons with that book. All right, take it easy. What's wrong with crayons and books, right? What's wrong with a good coloring book every once in a while, Staggy? So it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. I was a little hesitant to begin with, but I think it's important for me, especially through my battle of cancer, to tell this story, share it, and try to make it more than just a hockey book, kind of the life and times of a young kid coming from Chicago and kind of defining the odds and defeating the odds and getting to where I am today.
Hey, yeah, defining the odds. You're good at that, too. Hey, Edzo, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it so much. And all the best to you. Look forward to watching you the rest of the year on NBC.
Okay. Always great being with you, Staggy. Thanks, pal. Appreciate it.
Shaped by the energy and opportunity of downtown Pittsburgh, the Point Park University experience is unlike any other. It's a more active, more engaged, more professional education, ideally located. That's the point. Point Park University. Learn more at pointpark.edu.
Can't wait to read the book, The Life and Times of One Eddie Olczyk, Edzo, who has made such a big impact here in Pittsburgh, even though he's from Chicago, Illinois. Our thanks to Edzo once again, and I hope you've enjoyed It's a Great Day for Hockey Talk with Eddie Olczyk. I'm Paul Steigerwald, and we'll talk to you next time.